get on the right page could be a problem.
The House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome to the end of the week. And welcome to the committee. If you have a cell phone with you, if you would please turn it all the way to off, not just to vibrate, but all the way off. And we are going to go out of order today, and we are going to briefly open up House Bill 3050 so that Representative Berger can give us a presentation, and then we're going to move to our work session. So Representative Berger, and I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3050.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20, and I have brought with me a constituent and student at North High School who will introduce herself later. Her name is Krista Whitman. Basically, there are two levels of license plates. What we are asking for in this bill is a new one of the higher level, rating up there with Cultural Trust and Crater Lake, the high-level license plates. This bill would establish such a license plate. It would be dedicated to the educational foundations. Any revenue would be dedicated to educational foundations in K through 12 districts throughout the state. Most of the state school districts have such a nonprofit foundation associated with them. They do wonderful things. Krista and others can tell you more about that. They leverage money that goes right into classrooms. And while it isn't like this license plate would not be anything to solve the educational funding problems of this state, it's a vehicle for doing some interesting and innovative things in our classrooms. It's a source of funds and a source of sort of advertisement for our schools. We see it as a way of doing good things for schools on a whole number of levels. Now, I have to say, ODOT has pointed out there's a little bit of a problem in the drafting. We meant $35 per year for both plates, not each plate. In other words, it wasn't $35 for the back plate and $35 for the front plate. Okay, that was not our intention. So there's a little bit of a drafting error that ODOT has asked that I mention. And in the case, in order to sort of be fair, not all districts have an education foundation. Our vision for this, that money that is revenue generated off these license plates would go by way of the State Department of Education allocation through the formula to districts. If there was no educational foundation, it would go directly to the district, not to the foundation. And we have checked with the Department of Education on their willingness to be the conduit, because the money comes into ODOT, of course, and they don't know what to do with it then, so it would go by way of the Department of Education for distribution to the districts. With that as preamble, rather than ask me questions, I think you need to hear from Krista, because she has lived this bill for quite a while. Yes.
Yes, Representative Huffman.
I actually do have a question for you, Representative Berger. Is there any specificity in this as to how often the funds would be transferred to the foundations in a manner so they wouldn't be held in a pot of money that could potentially be swept out?
Now, that's a very interesting question, one that I had not thought of, and I can guarantee you, if this bill advances, we will resolve that very quickly. ODOT has a accepted method here of distribution for the plates that are existing. I will check with them and determine that, because it's a good question. We wouldn't want that to happen, at least I certainly wouldn't. So, Krista, can I give your name?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Krista Whitman. I'm a senior at North Salem High School, and I am also a member of the Board of Directors with the Salem-Keizer Education Foundation. As Representative Berger said, House Bill 3050 would create a specialty license plate with the money going to education foundations all throughout Oregon. However, if the school district does not belong to a foundation, the money would go directly to the school district. Our main goal for this bill is to help build stronger education foundations throughout the state. As a student, I see what the Salem-Keizer Education Foundation does, such as putting on the Awesome 3000, which has thousands of runners now this year, to putting on the Crystal Apple Awards and numerous of after-school activities. The Salem Kaiser Education Foundation started off as a small nonprofit organization and has now grown into a highly respected foundation that gives so much back to the school districts each year. There are foundations all over the state that are already founded, and this bill would help fund those foundations and help them grow as well. This license plate would be a choice rather than a tax for citizens to support the school districts all throughout Oregon. This bill was designed with the purpose being to enrich the quality of educational learning through schools all over Oregon. And in the end, the question that we need to ask ourselves is that if Oregon can support the Fish, the Cultural Trust, and even Crater Lake, then why can't we support students in Oregon? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thanks for all of the work that I know that you've done on putting this together. It's a very impressive project.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know who's best poised to answer this question. I went through there and I was listening for the testimony and maybe I missed it. So if I buy one of these plates, purchase one of these plates, does the money go ultimately to my school district, or is there some distribution formula that is used for it to go to various foundations? Because I want it to go to my school district.
Frankly, Rep. Springer, that was our original vision. In talking with ODOT, it's unworkable. Okay? There is no mechanism without adding FTEs, where we don't really want them, to try and match up you as a driver with you as your educational foundation. So our backup was to say, okay, we'll pool the money and redistribute according to the formula, which is, you know, follows the districts in a known way. And that reduced any fiscal impact significantly.
Thank you.
But that was our original vision. It just was unworkable.
Thank you. Are there further questions?
One other thing I want to add. There is talk that one of the things that you could, in order to get a plate like this going, you have to be able to put upfront money, because ODOT doesn't take the hit.
Right.
And the educational foundations would have to come together to put up the upfront money. Then when it's distributed, it would be distributed, as we said. One of the suggestions was, what would it look like as a plate? And one of the ideas was for how all these foundations run a contest and have students actually design the plate, which would give it advertising and awareness within districts and do lots of fun things to sort of get this thing wound in terms of people. It's sort of like the back of the coin thing so there's ideas like that out there. We know this won't solve all the educational problems in the state, but leveraging dollars that go into classroom is important. And what foundations do is bring in grant money, they bring in private fundraising money that leverages educational dollars, and this would go a long ways on that. Good stuff for schools.
Thank you very much. And if you can come up with a bill that solves all of the educational problems in the state,
we would
be happy to clear our calendar and take that bill up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I know that there is someone else that's here to testify in House Bill 3050. We're going to come back to this bill. We've got some other folks in the room that have to leave pretty soon here. So I'm going to now open a work session on House Bill 2834. So, colleagues, House Bill 2834 is the bill that concerns the Oregon School for the Blind. And the original House Bill 2834 created a task force that would study the School for the Blind. The amendments that we are working off of would basically be a gut and stuff of that bill and change it to a bill that would affect the closure of the Oregon School for the Blind. And you should have received in your email boxes yesterday a -1 amendment and a -2 amendment, which are very similar to one another. In fact, they are identical word for word to each other through page 32 all the way through section 40. The primary difference between the dash 1 and the dash 2 is that the dash 2 creates a statewide office of outreach and best practices for blind and visually impaired students. The dash 1 assumes that those activities would take place, but does it in a much less explicit sort of way. So the intention for today is to give the committee an opportunity. We've heard a lot of testimony. We've had a tour of the Oregon School for the Blind. We've taken about 6.5 hours of testimony on this issue thus far. And you should all have on your calendars next Tuesday night when we will take several hours more of public testimony starting at 5:30 on Tuesday night. But today is the opportunity for the committee to digest these amendments. We are not taking public testimony today, but I have invited some folks in the room that can answer some technical questions that committee members might have about the process of transitioning students back to local school districts and what regional programs may or may not be able to do on this timeline. So I leave it up to all of you, if you've read the amendments, if it would be helpful to have a brief overview of them, how would you all like to proceed?
There's a comment down
there. Yeah.
Chair Gelser, I would really appreciate an overview. Having not had time to review them, I would really appreciate an overview.
And great.
And I would like to hear from people in the business, those people who could tell me of the two versions, why is one better than the other? I mean, why it is specifically stating it, say, in the twos, why would that be better than the more obtuse one or otherwise? So that would be great for me.
Okay. And I can tell you that whatever we do, should we choose to move amendments like this, there will be a dash 3. There are some drafting errors related to the technical aspects of what the current duties of the School for the Blind are and how that dissolution would take place. So I'll do an overview. Before I do that, I also want to make an important clarification from the last meeting that we had. And you might remember a discussion about what are the different choices that are on the table for us, and so I'll give you all a brief overview of that. We have in our committee a bill from the Department of Education, which is House Bill 2113. House Bill 2113 would create a trust for the sale of the School for the Blind and then direct the monies that came from that to upgrade facilities at the School for the Deaf, and that would be a part of co-locating the School for the Blind at the School for the Deaf. And that is the proposal that the Department of Education is advocating. This proposal that we are considering is completely different in that it does not impact the School for the Deaf at all. It would close the School for the Blind, and it does not direct or require that there be any sale of the property, but it does say if the property is ever sold or leased that the proceeds that would come from that would go into a trust that could only be used for the benefit of blind and visually impaired students. And then, of course, what is always an option is the third option, do nothing. If we do nothing, if we do not move on the bill from the Superintendent of Public Instruction, if we do not adopt these amendments or move this bill, then everything would continue as it is today. Is that clear? I know there was a lot of confusion the last time we met. The other clarification that I have received since our last meeting from the Superintendent of Public Instruction is that if we do not move on House Bill 2113, which is their bill, so say we do absolutely nothing, the co-location then would not take place. It is not the superintendent. I now understand it is not the superintendent's intention to move forward with co-location without the passage of 2113, because that would leave her without the financial resource to make the necessary facilities upgrades to make that co-location possible.
Madam Chair, has the superintendent taken a position with respect to closure?
The superintendent's position continues to advocate for co-location. So any other questions on that piece of it, what our choices are, before I go on to the overview? So again, co-location, closure, or status quo, do nothing and keep things the way they are today. Representative Kopp.
And just for clarification, within the amendment, the dash twos and one, or is it dash twos and ones, as we go through it, you'll review what that, in quite a bit of detail about the trust and how the transference of funds will occur.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Yes. So I'm going to move through the dash two amendment because it incorporates everything in the dash one, and I'll just point out the place where it's a little bit different. Does that work? All right. So section one of the bill, and interrupt me as we go along as there are questions. So section one of the bill basically affects the closure. It says that the School for the Blind would be closed by September 1st of 2009. The reason that that date is set there is, first of all, so that there is no disruption of summer programs that are already planned there, and the second is to allow time for the quality transition plans to be made. Section 2, and the superintendent would then have authority in that closure there to determine when contracts ended and began in terms of after the school year ended. Yes, Representative Kopp.
And this may get way too technical, but so in part of that transition, because I was a special ed teacher, so if we move to do this, has it been considered about the need to rewrite all the IEPs and all that kind of stuff?
Yes, Representative Kopp, and that's addressed in a different section
okay.
that is coming up.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So actually, in the next session, so Section 2 requires that prior to August 1st of this year, Section 2, that prior to August 1st, a comprehensive transition plan would be developed for each student at the School for the Blind who otherwise would have continued to receive service there this fall. And what we're looking at in terms of this transition plan is not just the educational needs that the student might have, but also any human service needs that the student may have. So the Department of Human Services is asked to participate in these as well. One of the things that's important to remember is that as we get further into the bill, there's a recognition that when you make a change in placement, there is a capacity and infrastructure development need, and that's where some of this legacy fund money comes in later. So that pays for the human service needs, and that pays for any changes that might need to be made in a local community to accommodate for the student to come back. Yes, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe, like Representative Kopp, I'm getting ahead of the game or too far in the details here because my mind is just racing. How are those funds accessed? How are they determined? They're accessed from the district. And how's that going to work, or do we know that piece yet?
We know part of that piece, but not all of that piece, and it comes up in a later section of the bill.
We need to slow down.
I will just be patient, too.
We need to slow down.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're not going to assume that there would be a co-location. It would be approached as each student would have time spent on a comprehensive plan of reintegration into their community with the possibility that they might be co-located to School of the Deaf?
No. Thank you, Representative Huffman. That's an important question. If we move House Bill 2834, there would be no co-location of the two schools because the Oregon School for the Blind would cease to exist. There would be no school to co-locate.
Okay.
Does that answer that question?
Thank you.
So in the Section 2 in the transition plans, one of the pieces is making sure that this plan is written to ensure the successful transition. It requires that the plan shall offer a plan that is equal to the level, frequency, and type of educational services currently offered to the students at the school, and that actually is consistent with federal law, which is an IEP-driven process, and that the comprehensive plan, this lists out the types of things. This is really a prompting of the kinds of things a transition team might want to consider, assistive technology, adaptive curriculum and materials, equipment, staff training and development, access to summer camp, short-term residential programs, behavior support plans, and other resources that might be necessary. The bill also in subsection 4 here, and we're still in the section of the bill, talks about who would participate in putting the transition plan together. And again, this is basically a restatement, really, of people that are on an IEP team, but it calls out specifically people that we want to make sure are at the table for these: vocational rehabilitation, if that's appropriate. It's been difficult sometimes to get voc rehab at the table at IEP meetings for these individuals that would be required when they are of that age. It also has very clear language, and again, this is available to all students in special education, but we wanted to make it very clear here that the student or the parents have the right to invite any person that the student or parent believes could contribute to making this plan. And that's always true in IEP meetings as well, but sometimes people forget that. Representative Comp.
Chair, I'd respectfully request that as you go through this, could you tell us which page and which line you're on?
Yes, I'm sorry.
That would be really, really helpful for me. I don't know about others.
Yes, thank you. That. Right now, that just kind of ended up on page 3. That was running through section 2. Representative Huffman.
Madam Chair, quick question. Do we have any guarantees that, because one of the things I think collectively, I've kind of heard that we're concerned that we can't continue the cost of $150,000 per student. Is there any guarantee that if we pass this and they come up, it's going to cost $173,000 per student? Do we have any guarantees that the cost will be the same or less in integration into their local communities? How do we guarantee that we're actually going to be doing the best thing for the student and keeping the cost contained at the same time?
Representative Huffman, this bill, it doesn't have language that says that the program must be less expensive in the local community than what it is at the school. It's focused on the needs of the student, which is what special education law is based on. What we do know that will change is the kind of the auxiliary costs of supporting the school, so everything from, you know, maintaining the property and the grounds to the dormitory staff and residential staff, we would be able to focus all of those resources directly on educational programs. The other thing that would happen in local school districts, if a student goes back, currently the school districts aren't getting ADM for these students. The ADM goes directly to the school. But if the student is there, the school district that's serving them would then have access to the ADM, to the federal IDEA funds that come, to the regional programs and services that are offered to that student. And if those become costly services, that school district would then have access to the high-cost disability grant in order to offset those costs for those students as well.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dimbrough.
Just kind of following up on Representative Huffman's question, but looking at it in a broader context, what do you see the timeline for doing the budgeting work for this transition? I mean, students are going to move to the new system in September, as envisioned here, and so when are we going to figure out, you know, how much flows to each district, and how quickly do you think that can happen?
Representative Dimbrough, that can happen very quickly because the first thing that will follow each student back to their district is their ADM and what's accessible to them through the regional program. That doesn't require any new budgetary action. This legacy fund that is set up as the districts are putting this plan, as the teams are putting these transition plans together by August 1st, you'll then know what that picture is of what it is that the students need, and then there can be that access to that legacy fund to build any infrastructure that's necessary. And we do have the co-chairs of the management team of the statewide regional programs here who might be able to answer a little bit about the practical aspects of planning for the students to come in, if that would be helpful.
It would be for me, because I see just a lot of details that would need to be worked out fairly quickly, you know, in terms of purchasing equipment, just obligations that will probably flow to the districts. And when will they do that planning? I'd just like to have a more comprehensive vision of the implementation.
Do you two want to come on up? And if you could just start by introducing yourself for the record, that would be great.
I'm Mary Reed, and I'm Assistant Director at Willamette Education Service District in charge of regional programs for Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties.
I'm Paul Andrews. I'm the Director of Special Programs for High Desert ESD in Bend. And as far as the regional program goes, we serve seven counties, Crook, Deschutes, Jefferson, Harney, Sherman, Wheeler, and Gillum.
And could you talk to us a little bit about how that would work? You've got a high cost or a high need student coming in to a regional program. The time and the mechanics really of making the planning for the and is this doable, practicable on this timeline? Is that does that get to the gist of the question?
It does. Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Well, let me first say that right now, any student who comes in, the regional program and the school district are obliged to work together to figure out what are the services that are needed for that student to access their education. And so what we access right now are some of the things that Representative Gelser already mentioned, which is to say the high-cost student fund, things of that sort that would eventually be able to play into the high costs. Regional programs for 30 years have been in place to be able to address those issues for children with, among other disabilities, but vision, blind and visual impairment. We're working with students like the Children and Students at the Oregon School for the Blind all the time, and so I think those conversations would not be significantly different than the ones we're having for our existing students.
I would imagine that if this went forward, that we would definitely be having IEP meetings again and updating the IEPs to where they stand and the progress of the students at that point in time, and we would be assigning on the cover page, obviously, in special education, the services that need to be applied, of which we have available in regional programs for the expanded core curriculum, as well as Braille and low vision and orientation, mobility, and all of those. We have specialists licensed and certified in those areas.
What I would add is, over the last few years, as cuts have come to regional programs, we have been shifting many of those costs to the districts. For example, providing low vision support in Central Oregon, that is something that we have turned to the districts and said, we need you to backfill that because the regional programs are not receiving enough money to be able to do that. And so as we look at a child needing, whether it's Braille, whether it's large print, et cetera, we would be working with the school districts to be able to make that happen, assuming that regional programs are not funded than they have been.
And just to complicate it, it's different in every region based upon the cuts that regionals have, what has the districts have regarded to be their priority. That would not be the same as what Willamette ESD is doing.
Representative Kopp.
I would like to have information from ESDs about the equipment that they do have available already, not that they'd have to purchase. If they have Braille machines, what kind of technology supports equipment so that we could have a good pitch, a better understanding of what currently is being used.
You
don't have to answer all that right now. It's
okay.
Just for later on as
okay.
we get into the decision-making process.
Thank you. Representative Rivlin.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment to Representative, to the whole discussion here. And it goes that if you're in a school district and a high-need student comes, sometimes the amount of knowledge you get is the day before. When the parents have moved and they show up at the school and they say, here's this packet of materials that we're bringing with you, and we'd like you to know, we had an example where a student came and they could not be in any room that had ultraviolet light.
Right.
All of these have ultraviolet light, which meant every school light bulb had to be encased in a special tube for that person to be in our school. And they had a requirement to be in the school. And so we had to figure out how to get the tubes, get them to the school, and figure out ways for that person to be in a school that has multiple buildings. And that student can't go outside during the daylight time. And so how do we provide all the courses? oftentimes that you get a little knowledge because the school where they're coming from will tell you over summer that the parents are planning to move, but there are circumstances that happen with lots of other kids where it just happens. In this case, at least, we have X number of months to make those transition plans and to help the school districts acknowledge that it's going to happen. School districts understand that when the student is presented at their door, they have an obligation to serve them, and then they go finding the regional people and whoever else that can help them, and they pull together these teams fairly quickly. So, I mean, from the standpoint of logistically, when I look at this bill, I'm thinking, wow, this is pretty nice advanced knowledge from a school district's perspective that they would know all this is happening. We do have students who are blind or deaf who show up because something went wrong in the family's placement here, and there's a grandparent that lives in your district, and they get sent. So it is an obligation of the system, and we have ESDs that help us deal with that if you're a local school district, but the reality is you figure out a plan and you make it work for that individual child, and you go find the resources. And I'm sure that happened in SIO and all those other places. When you're a school board member, it's kind of a shock all of a sudden that you hadn't anticipated it. At least this way, everybody knows who these children are and probably where they're going to end up.
So. And do I remember correctly from our discussion with Director Wimmett that for students that are currently placed at the Oregon School for the Blind, their local school district members are currently members of their IEP team,
yes.
So are engaged with the students and their needs already?
Yes, and there's an expectation that the regional program is at the table as well.
So to follow up on that, as these transition meetings start to happen and folks start discussing this, the people that are at the table will already have knowledge of the student. It's not it's a student that they've had knowledge of previously.
Unless they moved in from out of state and kind of went quickly to the School for the Blind through that school district, that's a minor part of the population.
Thank you. Are there other questions on this point before we move forward? Representative Denver, did you get them answered?
Yes. Well, I have a lot of questions, and I think, you know, we're dealing with a process that is going to raise a lot of questions. And, you know, one is just following on the question of technology. So one of the things that we've heard from advocates for the School for the Blind is that there's an efficiency of having all these kids coming from all over the state to use the technology that they have at the school, whereas if they're sent back to their districts, all this technology would have to be duplicated, which would be much more expensive. And I'd like you to address that if you could. Is that a legitimate concern? Do you already have this equipment? Or, you know, I guess it kind of goes back to also to the question of what advantages do students have currently at the School for the Blind that we would have to compensate for as they move back to the regions?
Well, there's two different levels, Oregon Textbook and Media Center, but that's more materials and textbooks. But for the technology, they have an excellent program at School for the Blind and an excellent teacher who provides instruction kind of as a center. But every individual student needs to have that technology and needs to have that in the classroom. So it's not like you're going to have multiple students utilizing one piece of equipment together. Each student needs to have that for their own use and also to be able to access the general curriculum. So we have that, and we have collaborated with the School for the Blind because they have that central advantage for the technology piece for training. Doesn't, you know, whoever provides that training, it can be centralized. It is good. It is a good service, but each and every one of our students has that high braille computerized technology or large print.
I think it certainly is true that different regions are responding to it differently. Again, years ago when we were fully funded, we were using regional dollars for that. Just speaking for High Desert ESD, we have turned more to a regional assistive technology center. We fund, our districts fund through their local service plan, $68,000 for us to purchase for students, whatever disabilities, the technology they need in order to access their education. So that's how our region has addressed that. A child coming from the School for the Blind or from another state or wherever would have the same access to that in our region.
The summary would be it's a partnership between regional and the school district, and that's what's the same around the state.
Mm-hmm. And just following up, so you don't see a need for much expenditure in terms of purchasing additional equipment if we were to decentralize?
I do think there will be a purchase of equipment as an individual student who was getting it covered over here is moving to a new district. It will be in their IEP, presumably, and that new district will need to have access to that. If indeed there was a system in place in the Oregon School for the Blind that a number of students were accessing the same or a similar type of device, yes, it would be more expensive to have that duplicated in different sites as those kids go back to their individual districts. It seems to me, just having briefly read this, some of that is addressed in terms of funding following kids, as I understand it. But yes, I could see an additional cost there.
And if I could follow up. But you see that as being manageable within the current expenditure per student that we're spending for students who attend the School for the Blind. I mean, I think that's one of the premises, but behind the amendment.
I think it goes back to the systems that are in place. I mean, we would get, an individual district would get ADMW, they'd get the second weight for the child being special ed, and if that device and the other services add up to more than $30,000 a year, the school district has access to the high-cost funding bill. So I think there are systems in place. Definitely between that $12,000, $15,000, and $30,000, that does come from a district's general fund, and that would be something that a district would have to absorb. But again, regional programs work with them to try to find systems to help support that as well, including the regional dollars.
And I would point out, as we get later in the bill and it talks about the disposition of property, it does talk about the technology that is currently at the School for the Blind itself, following the students that are using it into their program. So if a student is set up with a particular piece of technology, assuming they're not sharing that piece of technology with another student, that piece of technology would follow them back to that regional program.
Representative Gelser, could I just add one more piece? The federal stimulus package as well, the IDEA portion of that, does explicitly mention assistive technology as a means of, as a reasonable expenditure of those additional dollars coming in, for what that's worth as well.
Any further follow-ups on this section about the transition plans? All right, section 3, so I'm now on the bottom of page 3, and so basically this says, except as otherwise provided by a collective bargaining agreement, a public employer shall give preference for a vacant position to an otherwise qualified person who worked for the Oregon School for the Blind. It also requires the Department of Ed to facilitate communication between displaced employees at the School for the Blind and school districts that are looking to hire folks to support either the kids that are transitioning or other kids that are coming in. A suggestion that I received today that would go into the amendment request is also, even though the language talks about public employers generally, it would be a good idea to specifically call out the DAS pool for the non-teaching staff that are there as well, to make sure that we're very explicit in making those connections and giving some hiring preference to displaced workers. Are there questions on Section 3? Section 4 repeals that part, so it gives that preference for basically two school years until 2012. So Section 5 abolishes the Board of Directors for the Oregon School for the Blind, and actually Sections 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 all are the technical amendments about shutting down the school and the School for the Blind. It's the legal language about what happens to the contracts. That language will likely change. This was, I understand, the boilerplate language for when a board is abolished. The board at the Oregon School for the Blind is an advisory board and does not actually have the capacity to have ownership of property or enter into contracts. So you'll see a lot of that language come out where it was not applicable. Sections 13, for a really long time, through 35, all change other statutes that reference the Oregon School for the Blind and remove those references So it's a technical change. Section 36 are the... So now we're all the way at page 28. So as you see, the bill that you have to read is actually much shorter than it would appear. So on page 28, section 36 are the operative dates for the sections of the bill, which basically go back to that September 1st date. Section 37 creates the Oregon Trust Fund for Blind and Visually Impaired Students. And you'll find as we go through this, there are two separate funds that are created. This is the trust fund, and the trust fund is... the money for the trust fund comes from any sale or lease of the real property or other property or land at the Oregon School for the Blind. That would go into this trust. And that trust could only be used for the purpose of furthering the independence and educational opportunities for students who are blind and visually impaired. And on page 29 in subsection 3, you'll see that this goes through to describe who these students are, that it is blind and visually impaired students, kids that are under the age of 21 who are receiving special ed services, so that picks up those 18 to 21-year-olds in those services, and then also students who are blind or visually impaired that are pursuing a degree at a community college or university system that graduated from an Oregon university. Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, lines 4 through 9, is that the impenetrable fence?
The impenetrable fence. I asked Legislative Council this question, and we can have them come back. It is my understanding that there is no such thing as a wholly impenetrable fence.
Mm-hmm. But this is a virtual impenetrable
fence. Don't use that word.
Even nearly.
A charter.
Yes. But that
helps.
It helps. This makes it, we asked to model this similarly to the Fairview Housing Trust, which came from the sale of the land and property at Fairview. And I know that some of us are concerned about, in our current budget environment, some of the choices that needed to be made. I would point out that no money was taken out of the Fairview Housing Trust, and that is what this is modeled on. Are there other questions on that?
It was damage.
It was damage.
Not Fairview.
Right, damage.
But then they put it.
The
interest put it back.
Was taken out.
Of damage, but not out of Fairview.
Okay.
But no principal was taken out of damage or Fairview.
Correct. Right.
Okay. And the other thing that's important to recognize about the trust, there's a difference between the trust and the legacy fund that we'll get to later. The trust is of a direct benefit to individuals who are blind and visually impaired. So that if money was spent from the trust to purchase a piece of equipment or technology for a blind or visually impaired Oregon student, that piece of property would then belong to the student. And the only restriction on the disposition of that property would be when the student no longer needed it, if there was still a useful life on that piece of equipment, they couldn't profit from it. They would have to donate it to another public benefit. That's different than what would happen through something that comes through an educational program where the property belongs to the educational program. So the trust directly benefits blind and visually impaired Oregonians without a buffer of a school district or a regional program plan. However, the trust can choose, there's a board that we get to in the next session, they can choose to take money from this trust and put it in the legacy fund that is created later, and we'll get to that in another section of the bill. Does that make sense? Clear as mud? Representative Springer?
Kind of. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still forming my question, trying to wrap my head around this. Would the trust money fund personnel costs or just equipment? I need that mobility expert here so the district accesses those funds.
It's an unclear question because I haven't even completely formed it.
Right. So that I understand the question that you're asking, though. So how, basically, what's the mechanism by which somebody accesses funds from this trust?
Yeah.
So the trust, if you look on in Section 38, there's the creation of a board of directors for the Oregon Trust Fund for Blind and Visually Impaired Students.
Page 30.
We're still on page 30. And that board of directors would establish the policy and procedures by which that money would be accessed. This is not set up in a way that it must flow through a school district, but that board will be making the decisions about the disposition of those funds and how best to distribute those out. The restriction being that it must be for the benefit of blind and visually impaired students to further their independence or their academics. So there's those broad parameters. We talked about trying to delineate specific kinds of things that you might use it for, but the concern was that if you start putting things in there, that would become limiting, and that we wanted to entrust this board with making those decisions. The other thing that's important about this is that you have that question of impenetrability, the difference between this trust and the trust that's created in House Bill 2113, in 2113, those dollars were then earmarked to go to the Oregon School for the Deaf to build that up. In this bill, this money, if there was a sale of the property or if the property were leased, that money would not go to the general fund. It would not go to repairs at the Oregon School for the Deaf. It could not be used for the benefit of anyone except for Oregon students who are blind and visually impaired. And this money is not used for the transition. This is wholly separate from that. The plan for transition of the kids is not dependent on what happens with the funds that are in the trust.
Representative Roblin?
On page 31, mm-hmm. line 9, at least one member of the board must be a person who is blind or visually impaired. I think that should read at least one voting member of the board.
Okay.
Just because you've got two legislators, and it could turn out that we have a legislator who is blind, would be there non-voting, and I think that there should always be a voting member that's blind.
That's an excellent point. I will add that to the amendment. Okay. Representative Dimbro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So where exactly does it say how the fund is funded, where the money for the fund comes from?
That is back in the front part of the bill, I believe. It may be in the back part of the bill. Hold on. Can you look for that while we continue moving through these?
Here, it's on page 5, Madam Chair. Line, I believe, line 13 through 15.
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's right.
Great.
Thanks.
Can we talk about this?
Okay.
So any other questions on Section 38? So Section 39 creates the term of office for the Board of Directors. Section 40 now talks about what happens with the land and the property, and it directs the Board of Directors, in consultation with the Governor and also the City Council of the City of Salem and the Mayor of the City of Salem, to develop a written plan or written proposal about what should happen to the property at the Oregon School for the Blind. And rather than summarizing, the written plan shall balance the following priorities: securing the best market value for the property, recognizing that the property was intended for the benefit of students who are blind and visually impaired, and giving consideration to the historic nature of the neighborhood where the property is located and compatible uses for the property. It also states that there can be no listing for sale of the property until a written plan that complies with these requirements is completed, and a plan needs to be written and submitted to the governor by June 1st of 2010. And again, this talks about any proceeds of sale or lease go to the trust fund for blind and visually impaired students. There's nothing in the bill that requires that the property be sold.
Representative Collins.
Chair, did you check with legal counsel? We had testimony earlier by a local constituent that that property was deeded for the sole purpose for these students, if that's going to be any problem in this process.
We are working on getting more information about that. However, as it relates to this bill particularly, because the bill does not require and is not predicated on the sale of the property, that becomes more of an issue for this board as they determine how to manage the property and what to do with it and what to do with it next.
Thank you.
And that's something that is, again, different about this proposal from other proposals in the past that have actually been predicated on the sale of the property. Representative Dimber, do you have a question?
No.
Are there other questions on this part? Yes, Representative Springer.
Representative Comp just brought up maybe an excellent point. It did bring up an excellent point. So, and we dealt with this in our school district, a reversionary clause. Years ago, the farmers gave the property to the school district for a school. If it's not a school, you don't have the property, plain and simple. And there were issues to deal with there, and that's fine, good and fine. If I give property, I get to say what it's going to be used for. That said, and I'm thinking this through, so we move through with the process of locating students back in their district. And as you said, and I agree, it is this board's job to determine that issue, mm-hmm. and they determine, oh my goodness, it can only be used as a school for the blind. Now, that's what I'm thinking.
And Representative.
And I know that sounds fairly contentious. I don't mean it to be, but I'm thinking, oh my goodness, now what?
And I think that is contentious, and I think that it is a concern, and that's one of the reasons why the plan was written not depending on any of the resource that's on that property. And it becomes a policy decision for this policy committee about the way that we structure educational services.
Absolutely.
And it may be, let's say that worst case scenario happens and it can only be used for a school for the blind. If the state legislature has made the policy decision that is not the model by which we choose to deliver services to students, then we would no longer have use for that gift, and maybe it would need to be reverted. But I would make the argument that it's our responsibility to make the policy decision, and the policy decision shouldn't be directed by a gift that was made over 100 years ago.
So that's point well taken.
Representative Comp, to say it a little bit differently, our focus is about the children, the students,
absolutely.
Not about the buildings and the property.
Yes.
Thank you.
Point well taken.
So Section 41, this is the second pot of money. This is the Blind and Visually Impaired Student Legacy Fund in the state treasury. It's separate and distinct from the general fund, and it keeps its own interest. Unexpended monies at the end stay in this fund. We're on the bottom of page 32. This is where it's different from the Dash 1, and I would suggest that probably the Dash 3 may read a little bit differently. This inadvertently created a whole new state agency, which wasn't the intent. Here it says that the money is continuously appropriated to the Office of Statewide Outreach and Best Practices for Blind and Visually Impaired Students. The idea is that we do have a coordinated effort where there is a place to call for technical assistance, that there is that statewide resource. It doesn't need to be a whole agency. But we're going to go through the Dash 2 amendments anyway, even though it mentions that. And that what this money could be used for, and this is money that would run through educational programs, it would be used to assist students who are blind or visually impaired in receiving appropriate resources and services, including educational services in the communities where the students reside. The reason this one is important is this is broader than educational services, because this fund is what's used to help plug any holes as we're transitioning these students back to their local communities. It could be that some of the students end up having richer plans than they might otherwise, but this bill says we want to make sure that these students have a plan that is the same level that they had at the Oregon School for the Blind. And so this allows for that in case an expenditure was not an appropriate expenditure by a school district. They could apply to use these legacy funds. And then supplementing the funds that are available to regional programs, an amendment has been suggested that would talk about, that would supplement the funds available to ensure that the regional programs are able to provide services to the entire expanded core curriculum that we've all heard a lot about. The next part is going to come out because it does not fit under the relating clause, and this is where we were trying to put in the vision screening program that we talked about earlier.
Okay, Chair, where are you?
You're now on page 33.
Right, but what line?
Line 6.
Okay, thank you.
So line 6 through 9, that will need to come out because it doesn't fit in the relating clause. And then another important part of this, if you look at lines 12 through 14, it states that money cannot be used to supplant any other monies available for purposes identified in subsection 2 of this section. So this is going to supplement what's already available in school districts and regional programs. This isn't going to create a situation where we're putting money in, you know, one portal of the regional programs and pulling it out of another. This becomes additive. And it also says that they can receive funds from the, you can get federal funds or from other sources. So that's section 41. Are there questions about that? And in this section, so in this section, the difference between this and the trust, in this section, students would access these funds and services through their school district or regional program, rather than directly. And that would be part of that coordinated system of services that happens in that way. So section 42, this is where the money is appropriated. And this number is based on what the legislatively approved budget was for the general fund allocation for the School for the Blind in 07-09. So this is the continuation of those operating dollars moving forward. And you'll remember that the... there's an error here. That should be a 6. This should be 6.75. This is based on So if you remember, the operating budget for the School for the Blind is roughly $8.5 million in this biennium. About $6.75 million of that is a direct general fund legislative allocation. The rest is other funds that are either federal funds or ADM that follows the student into the school. So this preserves that general fund commitment at the same level we did in the last session into this legacy fund.
Representative Chair, and so this $6.75 million, that is the operating budget for the facility?
Yes.
And so what happens when the facility becomes vacated and just, I mean, there are going to be ongoing maintenance costs, right? How is there a place for that in here?
And I think that we will hear about that in the fiscal, and we may need to add into the language of what this can be used for in the first year the costs associated with shutting down the school. I mean, the idea is that this is looking at the transition, and that would be inclusive of mothballing costs and those activities as well. And this, for the clean purpose of the policy discussion, this is based on the 2007-09 budget numbers. This is not reflective of whatever was on the 30% lists that were released today. And ultimately, the way the numbers are there is a discussion that would happen in the Ways and Means Committee after it left here. And there is money here that's also, it would be allocated dollar for dollar to DHS. So since we give students that are transitioning, they go to the front of the line for DHS services, even though there might be other people that have been waiting for years for those same services. We're going to put these kids at the front of the line for those services and then reimburse DHS dollar for dollar for those services. And that's the way we give them the services without taking them away from someone else that's been waiting for a long time.
Representative
Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You went down, you changed the 7.75 to 6.75?
Yes.
But the numbers that add up on line 1 is 6.5 million, and then 250,000, and then line number 3 is 1 more million. That is 7.75.
That is an error that I had not caught until just this minute. So that will get fixed. And it all comes off of the 6.75,
okay.
And it's actually $750,000 to the Department of Human Services.
Okay.
And the way that it would be structured in the amendment. Here it is in section 43 for the biennium beginning July 1st of 2009. This is lines 6 through 12, that it established by section 41, no more than $750,000 to the Department of Human Services for services provided to students through a comprehensive transition plan.
Okay.
And functionally, the way that would work would be a billing from the department for those services. Representative Comp.
Okay, so I'm a little bit confused. So the money that's addressed in section 42 lines 24 through 29. This is saying, is this some? I don't quite understand if now the students are allocated money according to the weighted formula. So then, as Representative Dembro asked, there was additional monies out of the general fund to just keep the facility, the paying of the electric bill and heating and all that kind of stuff, and that came up to the six-something million?
The $6.75 million that was there, that is the general fund, that is currently what's allocated to the general fund, from the general fund to the School for the Blind. A lot of that is instructional service to the students. Because the students, when they're going to the School for the Blind, they get there twice 8 a.m.
Right.
And then everything else has to come from general fund to pay for the function of the School for the Blind.
Yeah, I'll just have to have somebody work with me and explain it. It's Friday afternoon, and it's just like, okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the general fund amount over and above all of the money that came out of the school fund. So the school fund sent all their money to the school.
Right.
And that's not included in this 6.75. This is separate, individually line-itemed money sent just to the School for the Blind to augment their services, provide for those same kids. And they could use it in lots of different ways, but it's over and above the amount we gave from the school fund.
Right,
which they also received.
So to clarify, though, but we are saying that will go into this trust along with...
In the first year.
The first year?
Or the first biennium. I mean, that's what this says.
What it will do, not into the trust, into the legacy fund. Into the legacy fund.
Regardless, it won't go straight back into the general fund, into the full student formula.
As
it never was in the formula.
Right, got that part, but it won't go back into the general fund.
Correct. And the point of doing this in this way is again going back to the discussion that we're really having is a policy discussion about the way that we structure services to the students.
Right.
And the idea is, how do we continue, if the point of the discussion isn't to save money, it's to change the way we do services, we're saying, okay, we're going to earmark and hold on to the money we're currently spending, we're just going to redirect it and use it in this different way through the legacy fund. If we sent it back to the general fund, we risk losing track of where those dollars go and diverting them off to other purposes rather than continuing the support of the education of the nearly 900 blind and visually impaired students in the state. And that's really what this does. It takes that $6.5 million and spreads it out after taking care of the transition costs to the benefit of the 860 that are served in the regional programs instead of just the 31 that are served at the School for the Blind. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Well, I respect your perspective on that.
Mm-hmm. Would you do it a different way?
I may well. I don't. I haven't processed it enough to. Yeah, but I do totally respect that viewpoint. Mm-hmm. President Dembro.
So the legacy fund disbursement decisions are going to be made by whom? I mean, the other fund is going to be made by the board of directors.
Right.
It's going to be created. This here, it's going to be as part of the Department of Education. infrastructure.
In this dash two, that decision gets made by that statewide office. So we have to massage that as we put this through here. The intention here really is that in this first biennium, it's tracking. We're going to have oversight of the way that the kids transition. In future bienniums, the idea is this is primarily going to run through the regional programs to supplement what they're doing there.
And how will it be, I mean, how will those decisions be made? I'm just, you know, kind of speculating. Initially, we're going to do these disbursements based on where the current students in the School for the Blind are heading, right? But, you know, the School for the Blind, you know, of course, is there for the current students, but it's also presumably there for potentially future students.
Correct.
Who are coming from just all over the state, potentially. And so, will you know? Do you see these funds going out in a sort of ADM manner to the different regionals, or what are your thoughts on that?
The way that I would see these funds going out, ultimately, it is a ways and means discussion decision about how they go out. The way that
just for the record, I'm not thinking about making something different.
No, but I mean that's why we're all here. This is, you know, one set of ideas, and that's the point of this day. The way that I would envision them going, and we need more clarity in the amendment that we'll get it, especially if we take the statewide office out. In my imagining, it would flow in a very ADM kind of way through the regional programs in the way that we allocate to regional programs. Because the idea here is to redeliver this resource back through the structure that we've set up, that we can do a better job by providing more resources to them. If we did that, we would nearly double the resources that are available in the regional programs for blind and visually impaired students from what they are today, which I would argue would lead to a substantial improvement of services for all of those kids if you're doubling the resource that's available to them. So section 44, this is the vision screening program, and again, it doesn't fit under the relating clause, so that will all come out in the next amendment. Section 45, it also will come out because that goes to that vision screening component as well. Section 46 comes out, that's also related to the vision screening. Section 47 is the establishment of that statewide office of outreach and best practices. Again, this set up a whole new agency, and I would argue that we probably want to amend that so that we can preserve the resources for direct educational benefit. Probably what we would do is take the language on page 38 in lines 6 through 14 and reformat those to put them back under the legacy fund. And that would really point to we're establishing this centralized resource through that regional fund. By not putting that in statute, that allows the agency and the regional programs and the school districts to work together to align it in a way that's actually going to work for kids and doesn't create multiple levels of bureaucracy that we might all prefer to not have. And that is, and then you've got your emergency clause effective dates. And that's the amendment. Representative Huffman.
If we could go back to section 40 on pages 31 and continued on 32. I've never had any dealings with the disposal of state property, state-owned property, but I noticed that there's not a statute that kind of sets a framework for how to dispose of it, and I see that a plan will be developed. I don't see any language here that, like for the Elliott State Forest, for the Common School Fund, though it's not being done, arguably, constitutionally we're supposed to be managing that for the maximum value.
Right.
And I think it would be good to put something in here that the property should be disposed of, or whatever the terminology is, for maximum value. And I'd like a little clarification on consultation with Salem City Council and Mayor, because they're not
property owners some input, you know, would be appropriate to fit in with a city plan from Planning Commission or something, but I guess I'm just kind of being thoughtful about
right.
how much input we would allow, because we probably, as a state, we need to look at maximum value.
So would you be more comfortable with changing the word consultation or just taking the sentence out altogether?
Personally, they have no ownership. Okay. To me, it kind of complicates the situation.
Okay.
Maybe I'm being petty.
I don't know.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Maurer.
Two comments. One is to Representative Huffman's statement about maximum value. I think that somewhere we need to put that in there, because maybe sale is not maximum value. Maybe long-term lease ultimately is maximum value over the course of time. The other thing is the statement that policy that was or make relying on a document 100 years ago that affects policy today has gotten us in trouble in the past when we've not taken that into consideration through various treaties. And so I would be very careful not to just throw that out
right.
and say that that is not of serious concern to me. They're here to come get me. That that we need to be very careful that we are proceeding in a prudent manner
mm-hmm.
That is not in violation of those deeds, because those documents they have meaning, and they have meaning in perpetuity. Because that's what those deeds say, in perpetuity. So I'm just, that's a, to me, that is a strong cautionary note.
And Representative Maurer, to clarify my earlier comment, I don't disagree with you. I think that is an important issue. I think that what this bill is about, however, is about how we're delivering services to students. And there may be deeds in terms of a gift or property. I don't think that we should allow that to direct how we decide to deliver services if we choose that there is a smarter, better, more efficient way to serve kids. Where that becomes a question is in the second part of if there is a lease of the property or a sale of the property or it reverts, that's where that issue comes in. And that's one of the reasons why the planning for the transition can't and should not be tied to the value of the property itself. The two pieces really need to be separate and distinct from one another. But clearly, any action that is taken with regards to the property does need to be very carefully vetted to ensure that it is within the legal requirements of the deed.
And one follow-up is that I believe DAS deals with disposal of state property.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I would have to assume that they have a very standardized process.
And that was one of the other suggestions that came in today in terms of amendment to the bill, is to clarify there's a place here where it says that the Department of Ed would hold the property in trust while these decisions were made, that really should be DAS instead, and that would set in motion all of those pieces.
Okay.
There other questions, concerns, suggestions? Our next work session on this is next Friday. If the committee chooses to move forward with this bill, it's important that we get the bill on track to its next stop, which is the Ways and Means process. And that is one of the reasons we have a work session scheduled for next Friday, a week from today. So it's important to get amendment requests in to Hannah as soon as possible. So if you have those, if you could get those to me this afternoon, even if there are ideas, she can start noodling on them this weekend so we can get them moved through and have our paperwork ready. Representative Dimbrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I want to take advantage of having our regional specialists here. You know, we're talking about a pretty rapid timeline on implementing this, and I just want to make sure that you know, we don't act in a way that we're ultimately going to regret. And so from your perspective, how is the three-month period, or however, you know, say from, you know, in June, certainly you should have certainty if we do decide to move forward with this, until the beginning of September, is that going to work for you? That's kind of a simple, blunt question.
Sure. I won't say it's not a concern. What I will say is that the questions you asked earlier about the distribution of the legacy fund, for example, when I spoke earlier about the districts and the regional programs being able to work with these students, it was predicated on the idea that the legacy fund would come with additional money to be able to deal with the expanded core curriculum for these students, to be able to look at the needs of these students. If there isn't a quick and easy system in place, that is a concern of mine. We currently are, frankly, underfunded to be able to serve our kids as effectively as we should be. And our districts are backfilling us in order to be able to do that. And to be able to turn to them now and say, we need you to backfill us even more, I don't need to tell you, it's not a good time to do that. So I have concerns.
I don't have concerns about the logistics of it, about the IEP process, and getting resources and services in place. I think that can be pretty completely done. As far as the expanded core curriculum, we are implementing that, but as Paul is saying, from High Desert, we're on a reduced budget. So if we're in the long run that these things start coming into place and sequencing and money does actually get earmarked, like the legacy fund, it's not right up front or right away because all of our students are in that same boat, then I would be not concerned about that. But the monies would have to be there at one point eventually, mm-hmm. or we would not be able to do the expanded core curriculum throughout the day and evening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the goal of the plan is to ultimately, you know, substantially increase your resources, and the challenge is getting to that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can I ask a clarifying question? So if we, if the effective date of this bill was September 1st of 2009, or the effective date of the bill was September 1st, 2010, either of which this legislature would need to pass out of this committee and out of the building within the next couple of months, would that concern be the same about the function of that legacy fund? I mean, is it the issue of, does it make a difference if it's 09 or 2010? Is the issue writing the IEPs and being prepared for the students, or is it the issue of making clear, yeah, we really want those legacy funds?
I would say that I agree with what Mary said, that putting together the IEPs, the transition plans, we do that all the time. I'm not worried about that at all. It really is the legacy funds. Is would we have the resources to be able to immediately absorb all those? And I am kind of getting back to the expanded core curriculum being the area that I'm most concerned about. Would we have those in place right away? Would we have the resources to be able to implement them?
And would that be different if the effective date was 09 or 010? Would you have that same concern?
I assume so, yes. I mean, I guess the one advantage would be in that year would something be clearly put in place that would make it more comfortable for me as an administrator to say, yes, it looks like that clearly is going to work this way. That would be the only difference, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the expanded core curriculum currently being offered to students out in these districts right now?
We have eight regions, and so we talk together, and for the most part, yes. I know in our region it is, not the same as it was 10 years ago, but yes, all the nine expanded core curriculum areas are covered.
I will say, in speaking for my staff, there is a great deal of frustration about their ability to do that. in terms of, again, the amount of resources for them to be able to. I have trained staff to do orientation and mobility. I have trained staff who have the knowledge and the licensure to be able to do everything that's required. The ability to do it just within a school day, in addition to a child with a vision impairment needing to access the regular core curriculum, is a real difficulty. And so as we look at how do we do that then, we're looking to other grants. We're looking to other ways of getting that and doing it outside of the school day. And so that requires additional resources.
So would you say that, would it be accurate to say that the access to the expanded core curriculum for the, is it 840 students?
You're right, about 860.
So if we were to move forward with this plan and essentially double the budget resources that you have available in your regional programs, could you tell me what is the outcome of doing that expanded core curriculum with this plan versus without this plan?
You mean if that kind of dollar amount came through
right.
to be able
right.
to
the difference
that?
Between the status quo today, so say the committee chooses to do nothing, what happens to the 840 kids in the expanded core curriculum? What happens if we move forward with this plan and your capacity to do the expanded core curriculum?
It seems to me it allows us to have a lot more creativity in terms of how we address the expanded core curriculum. One of the things we've talked about within our own region is should we just be talking about our staff working from 7:30 to 4:30? Should we also be talking about some time after school? This would make that more likely. With current staffing, that's very difficult to do because we've got to just get them into the classrooms when the kids are there. So I think I'm not suggesting or saying that Region 2 is going to do that, but that's an example of how we can be creative if we have additional resources.
I agree. If we have those kind of resources, we would be able not only to resurrect what we used to do, but we can expand on that and do some centralized work as well, bringing children together from around the state to have experiences as well, in addition to each individual eight regions employing the expanded core in the home, in the community, in the library, in the grocery store. And that is what the expanded core curriculum is about.
Thank you. Representative Springer, did you have a...
Yes, thank you. And I don't know if this is a question to be answered today. I'm just posing this issue on the table. From the sidelines, I watched... definitely from the sidelines, watched an issue unfold in a district nearby my district within the last 5 years, for sure. I don't know all the details, so the point is not to compare... These may not be apples to apples that we're comparing, but I think we would be prudent to look into this. Had a student with special needs, don't know what those were, and there was a significant change in that, and lawsuits ensued, and now the district, at the tune of multiple $200,000 or $300,000 a year, is educating that student in another state. I think that we would be prudent and wise. Maybe that's a great task for Kevin, of course, by your discretion, Chair, to look in and see what legal precedence was maybe set by that action. I just don't have enough information, but I certainly think it would be prudent for us to get some of the particulars and the precedent on that may have been set.
Thank you. If
I could follow up real quick.
Oh, follow up.
I realize this isn't a money issue. However, when we're looking at multiple students and we could have a couple $300,000 attached to each, we need to be very careful as we move forward.
Representative Roblin. I just want to clarify the point that was made, I think, in your answer to Representative Gelser. If the legacy fund is implemented the way it is in this bill, and that money flows through to the regionals, that not only would those 36 kids who are currently at the School of the Blind, when they come back, have that extended program enhanced, but so would the other 860 kids. It would all be enhanced for all of them. So instead of affecting 36 kids, it would be affecting the total group of blind kids in our state. Is that what I heard?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And Representative Gelser, also, just to know money-wise, and it's not a money issue, is that in doing current figures, it's about $8,000 per student for the regional application to these to their programs in the districts. If you included what the district does with, you know, a classroom or something like that, it's about $25,000 to $30,000. So right away, you're into a situation where you have used for a low incident, high cost type of population. You've got a pretty nice system in place to take care of that.
Thank you. Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, you're talking about the summer programs or the, you know, the programs that would bring students together. How do you think the budgeting on that ought to be handled? I mean, should there be a, you know, a pot of money, a standing pot of money for that to make that possible on a regular basis? Or should that, I mean, presumably that would also be legacy money for that. And so would that come in the ABM manner?
Well, and Representative Rowe, if I could follow up briefly on that. I think one of the things that's important to know about the summer programs at the Oregon School for the Blind, those programs are offered outside of the legislatively appropriated money. Although they occur at the site of the School for the Blind, they are not paid for by the School for the Blind. They are paid for by a combination of tuition from the students and grants from nonprofit organizations and others. So currently, that's even though it's at the site, it's not currently provided by.
So you don't see anything changing then, as far as that goes.
I'm leaving that to your group. as far
you don't
as
see anything
funding.
Having to change, as far as that. You could still apply for grants or use tuition, or we just have to find a site for them, presumably.
It does seem to me there would need to be a system in place. I mean, the way this was written, to have the Office of Statewide Outreach, presumably, and I heard Representative Gelser say that that wouldn't be the way, there would have to be an entity in place that would apply for the grants. Now, we currently, we're the co-chairs of the regional management team, but in terms of the everyday administration and working with the various regional programs, the funding of Oregon Department of Education includes some grants. For example, for the autism program, Willamette ESD receives a grant to help organize that for all 8 regional programs and for the rest of the state. So I think something like that would need to be in place. Currently, we often turn to Don Wimette to help us with talking about those sorts of things. So if that went away, there would need to be something that replaced that.
Are there other questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this has been asked. Maybe I'm going to ask it the same or a different way. I don't know. Does this scare you guys, or can you handle what you would be asked to do with these students?
In those terms, Representative Huffman, I'm not scared, and we could handle it. And I'm trusting that what you're discussing here today is how that would proceed. In that, with those caveats and those the structure, I'm confident that it can be done in a way that will really benefit our children and our students.
I would say I am not scared. I think that it is critical that for every single one of those 33 students, that we are following through on at least what's in here in terms of making sure that we recognize this is a gigantic change for them, for their families, for the system. And so I don't want to sound cavalier by simply saying, yes, I'm not afraid. I believe that this is more than a money issue. This is more than a can the districts do it or can't they? Are regional programs good enough or aren't they? We're talking about kids and families' lives. And so that needs to be more than just a sure we can do it.
Thanks, Representative Comp.
Thank you. Are you aware if you of the disabilities that the students currently are identified with at the School for the Blind, and do you have students in your regions that have the same disabilities in that you're currently serving?
Yes, I don't know the students individually very well at all, But in terms of what I know about them, in terms of having multiple disabilities, and that, yes, we have all of our regions certainly have children like that, and we do have infrastructures in place for serving them.
And I do know the children and students at the School for the Blind and the staff there pretty well, and our individual students there. And we certainly could serve our students in the regional program. I do know and have heard testimony from parents, you know, for a student with autism as well, and the behavior issues around that, and how the placement of the School for the Blind really benefited that student. So that's not from my region, but that's there. So whatever would happen in the structure with this, and that's, I think, what Paul is reservation is a little bit, is with a legacy fund, to be really putting together a program that would support that student a better way than what the district and regional program have been able to do.
Just a follow-up comment?
Yes.
Thank you, because as Representative Roland stated earlier, it is really very appropriate for us to hear your voices, because you are very intimately involved with your programs, and it does help us to have an understanding. So thank you.
Thank you. And I'm going to take one more question. We've got another a lot of people on the next bill that we need to get to. Representative Huffman.
Quick sideline. I'm sitting here thinking as a parent, and under the current circumstances, you know, the parent's child has been away from home all week, and they have had a certain amount of freedom. Is there anything through the legacy funds or anything to allow parents a stipend to have in-home care or anything for a period of time to actually have some time to get away from the house? And
Representative Huffman, yes, actually. You'll remember that one of the pieces that's required is that the Department of Human Services is involved in the planning, and an eligibility be done for any available human services, and that these students would go to the front of the line of that eligibility. So whether that's family support, in-home services, in-home care, respite, if they have eligibility for those services, they would be available to them. Any further questions? All right, thank you both very much for sharing your ideas. And committee, remember, 5:30 on Tuesday evening in hearing room 50 is our final public hearing on this matter. Yes, Representative Springer.
And just to plan accordingly, and I'll be there and I'll commit to that. Is there an ending time, or we're done when we're done?
We are done when we are done. However, we will be more structured in the way we're taking the testimony that evening. Each person will be limited to 3 minutes. We will use an egg timer. The one exception to that will be we'll give a 20-minute panel at the beginning to the Oregon School for the Blind Board. With recognition, we want to hear what everyone has to say, but I also know there's a point at which you all need to eat dinner and go to bed. So with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2834. I'm also going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3050. We've heard that our witness is willing to wait. So I'm actually going to hold that over until Monday. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3205. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Mitch Greenlick, State Representative of House District 33, representing three school districts, Portland, Beaverton, and Hillsborough. And I'm here to introduce House Bill 3205 to you with the co-sponsor of the bill, Representative Comp, readily available for you. First of all, let me point out there are two parts of the bill. One is the first 7 sections, and the second part is the last section, Section 8. Section 8 is a really simple, straightforward piece that allows any school district to create a child development specialist bill rather than only school districts with elementary schools. It's to allow that. I understand there's some issues with the Oregon Department of Education about the whole question of the childhood development specialist, and if it gets all confused with that, I think we're prepared to jettison Section 8 in favor of the first 7. but you need to talk to my co-sponsors as well. Not that she can speak for herself. But Section 1 through 7 is, I think, a very important session. Bill, the work on that started last session when Representative Comp and I worked together on the Education Committee, and the work there and the work on the Health Care Committee dealing with the autism tsunami that's about to hit our state, that has hit our state. And it got us looking at the resources available in the school system to deal with what's happening in the schools. And we're also working with DHS to get them ready for what's happening to the Department of Human Services on this issue. It turns out that more and more of kids with problems end up in the regular classroom now. It isn't quite as simple as saying, well, we deal with disease X, autism, or some other deal in special education, and we have the resources to deal with it in special education. What's happening now is kids with autism and various forms, kids on the autism spectrum, and other problems are showing up in the classrooms. And because of financial issues, the classrooms are getting larger, and therefore we're leaving teachers and the school environment to deal with a much more complex set of issues than has been the case in at least in past decades. I think this has been going on at least for a decade, but in past decades that hasn't happened. And as we explored the potential for what's happening in the schools, it was very clear that we're leaving out a significant resource of personnel available to the school, to the school community, and that's social workers. So I began talking with the people at the Portland State School of Social Work, where I once was on the faculty many years ago, trying to teach social workers research. You can imagine what that was like. But at any rate, I was involved, started talking, and I found out that while the schools of social work now train people to be clinical social workers, and they train people to be community organizers, and they train people for other social work roles, they haven't had formal programs in training social workers to be school social workers, even though many social workers that they trained had their experience in the schools and were therefore eligible to be working in the schools. But there, as the child development specialist programs became scarcer and scarcer, there literally wasn't a way for the school administrators to hire social workers in a way that they felt confident they could be reimbursed for and that they could fit into the school. In exploring that, I found that the School of Social Work would be very interested in creating a school social work curriculum, which would train social workers specifically to be working in the schools. And you'll hear from the social workers and from the faculty in that school the kinds of things that social workers would be doing. When I brought this to the Representative Kemp and I brought this to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, we encountered a lot of resistance to them taking on the question of how you might certify social workers in, for example, the same way they now certify school psychologists. There are clinical psychologists, and there's a board of clinical psychology called something or other. I'm involved in trying to deal with those boards. They license some counselors, and they license some psychologists, two different boards. But there's also programs for training psychologists to be working specifically to the function, affectionately known as school psychs, and those people are certified by the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. They also certify counselors for a variety of roles, but there seemed to be this reluctance to certify social workers. It turns out, and you're going to get a message from Ms. Chamberlain in opposition to this bill, based on some board action, that she now tells me was based on a misunderstanding of what a licensed social worker does, how licensed clinical social workers fit into the social work spectrum. And the commission, and you'll have somebody, I suppose, from them testifying, although I understand there's written testimony from Ms. Chamberlain, about the problem they've had clarifying when, for example, a speech pathologist is licensed by the board that licensed speech and language pathologists and the TSPC certification of them. Well, she's now found out that there is no conflict on the social work side because the social work bill isn't a practice act, it's a license protection act, and it only is related to social workers who want to carry the licensed clinical social work title. So I just urge you to look into this. I urge you to work this bill and to pass it. It simply will get the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to take seriously how to produce some more trained personnel to be dealing in the classroom and in the school environment with special needs kids, because it's the social workers among all of these people that are really trained to deal with the kind of problems that are now being encountered by the school environment and by teachers particularly in dealing with so many of the special needs kids that they deal with. With that, I'll end. Do you have any questions? If not, I'll let other folks speak for themselves. And thank you very much for hearing this bill, and I urge you to move it along.
Thank you, Representative Greenleaf, for bringing it and for your patience as our work session ran over previously. So I'm going to move along and invite Jessica Ritter, William Zahner, and Susie Snyder, please.
Chair?
Yes, Representative Kopp.
Thank you. I was planning on testifying, but I'm not going to because of the time limits and the people that have waited so patiently, but I am definitely in support of this bill.
All right.
I'm shocked.
And let me ask, is there anyone that has signed up for this bill that is able to return to the building on Monday if I hold it over? So can the two of you do that on Monday? That's great. Thank you. Are you Keith?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. So I'm going to hold you guys over till Monday. All right, please. And if you'll begin by stating your name for the record, that helps us with that record keeping.
My name is Holly Petrie. I am stepping in and reading for Jessica Ritter.
Thank you.
I'm William Zenner, licensed clinical social worker. I'll be testimony.
And you can wait right when you begin your remarks, and then if you state your name on the tape, that makes it easy to know who was making
okay.
The remarks for the record. Thank you.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, my name is Jessica Ritter, and I am an assistant professor of social work at Pacific University. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the National Association of Social Workers. The National Association of Social Workers, Oregon chapter, is comprised of 1,800 professional social workers, researchers, faculty, and students. Many of our members work for community nonprofit agencies and public agencies, delivering a range of health and social services to Oregon's residents. NASW urges your support of HB 3205, a bill which would create a process for certifying school social workers. Social workers have unique skills and training to identify and develop strategies to meet the needs of the most vulnerable among us, including children. Unlike many other academic disciplines, accredited social work programs require a minimum of 400 hours of supervised practice experience for baccalaureate programs and 900 hours for master's programs. Social workers are provided with the knowledge, values, and skills to assist people in need and to address social problems. Every year, social work programs graduate students who find employment in a range of diverse settings, such as hospitals, mental health agencies, domestic violence shelters, criminal justice agencies, child welfare agencies, homeless shelters, residential facilities that serve older adults, advocacy organizations, and schools. Social workers are uniquely qualified to work with children in schools, and this is a common and established field of practice for social workers. There's a national organization called the School Social Work Association of America. The School Social Work Journal is a refereed publication that publishes research used to improve the practice of school social work. NASW first developed national standards for school social work services in 1978. In every state, you can find social workers working in the public schools who are performing group and individual counseling, including crisis counseling, assisting with dropout prevention, developing strategies to address school violence, including sexual assault and bullying, making home visits and serving as the link between the family and the school, supporting children experiencing a range of psychosocial problems such as homelessness, mental health issues, abuse and neglect, teen pregnancy and substance abuse, working with children in special education and those with a range of disabilities such as autism, providing behavioral assessments on kids who have difficulty maintaining the classroom, and connecting children and family members to needed services in the community. I am a social work educator, and every year I have students tell me that their passion is to work with children in a school setting. And every year I have to explain to them that their chances of finding a job in a public school in Oregon are very slim, since there is not a mechanism in place for hiring school social workers. There are thousands of at-risk and vulnerable students in Oregon who would benefit from having a social worker in their school. HB 3205 will decrease barriers for social workers in school settings so schools will have the flexibility to hire the right mix of staff to meet their needs. Thank you for hearing HB 3205 today, and I urge the committee to consider moving this bill forward.
Thank you. Okay, I'm Susie Snyder, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I work at Portland State University as an assistant professor, and I'm also a practitioner in the field and have worked as a school social worker in the past. And I'm here to talk about the unique contributions that social workers can make and do make in Oregon schools. Social workers have been well prepared with key skills and important perspectives when it comes to providing services in schools, particularly in areas such as addressing school failure and obstacles to learning, preventing dropout, dealing with poverty issues, intervening with mental health issues such as autism, reaching out to high-need families, closing the achievement gap. All of these are things that we are particularly well prepared for in our graduate education. There's four kind of unique perspectives that make up social work that lend themselves to our work in the schools, and I wanted to just briefly touch on them. One is the ecological perspective, and this is something that's kind of drummed into students throughout their 2 years in the master's program. But it's a basic understanding that problems occur in a context, and it's really important to understand the context of problems and that you don't just want to work with students one-on-one, but think about the families and the environments that they're in. And so social workers are very interested in looking at those environmental issues and contextual issues and intervening with them. The second one is working with disadvantaged and marginalized, diverse, and high-risk populations. And so there's a commitment to reaching out to the kind of hard-to-reach, the intimidating-to-reach populations. And social workers are trained to work with reluctant families and to do home visits and kind of be in those environments without feeling overwhelmed. We do, for social workers who end up working in the schools, there's 2 years of internships, and 1 year is usually in a school, and another year is usually in a community agency working with a high-risk population. And so social workers have that experience working with families, working with mental illness, addictions issues, those kinds of things. The third kind of principle that's part of social work education is the idea of comprehensive service delivery. And so students are taught to intervene on five levels: the level of the individual, the family, looking at the group and the agency or community environment. And so we also emphasize focusing on the level of prevention as well as remediation. And because of that education, social workers often become the movers and shakers in schools. They do a lot of looking at policy, becoming effective advocates, creating community partnerships, and programs. And the fourth area is focusing on strengths and assets and prevention. And so social work school emphasizes the idea of collaboration, and we're really encouraging students to think of themselves, positioning themselves as appreciative allies with consumers, with families. And I think that the social workers that come out of our program are especially good at building those kinds of alliances and intervening with families from that place. I wanted to just mention that social workers are very well prepared to meet the standards that have been set out, the national standards that are set out by the Association of School Counselors, and that we really do emphasize the need for a shift from individual and purely academic focusing, counseling, and guidance to look at the whole person and the social environment. And that's something that the Association of School Counseling Association is emphasizing. It's something that's very part of a social work education. Right now, I am a liaison liaison or advisor for 20 students who are placed in school settings with the school, and we have many students every year that do internships in school settings as part of their social work education. Unfortunately, those social work interns, while they're making a contribution to Oregon schools currently, have to usually leave the state in order to get jobs in schools. And so the schools are very pleased to have them as interns. They provide services that are very valued. Often the administrators want the chance to hire them into positions that are available, but they're not able to right now because there have been more and more constraints against social work jobs being available in schools. And from the bill is based on the notion that if there was TSPC licensing, that would help a lot, because that's what administrators have been telling us, that if social workers were licensed by TSPC, they would be able to hire them into positions. Also, there was a child development specialist category that's been kind of sunsetted out, that's made it less available for social workers to be hired into those positions. And so that's meant it's that much more important for them to be TSPC licensed so that they can get hired into the positions that require that.
I'm going to ask you to summarize,
okay,
because we have about 8 minutes and five more people.
Okay. I will call your attention to a chart that's the second page of my testimony, and I won't read through it, but it just describes some of the particular challenges that are faced by Portland Public School and the ways that social workers are trained to do that, deal with those, and are dealing with them. So challenges of poverty, diverse and immigrant students, high dropout rate, and special education needs. And finally, I just wanted to say a few things about my concerns that have come up about messages that have been coming out, and I had the chance to read one position in opposition to this bill, that are implying that social workers are not qualified to serve as the primary student service providers in schools. And I wanted to say that we support the school counseling programs and think that they're doing wonderful work in schools, that school counselors do wonderful work, but we feel it's inaccurate and destructive for them to maintain that they're the only professional discipline qualified to provide these central services. We think that social workers have a long history in this nation and in Oregon of providing services in those primary positions. And we have many examples of social workers that are currently doing that and have done that in this state. We have many letters from principals who have said that they like hiring social workers into these positions, that they serve them well, but they can't currently hire them because of the limitations around them not being TSP certified. So I just want to say we're concerned with this trend and that we feel like TSPC licensing would help to open this access, that there's no current research evidence to support the idea that school counselors are lay claim to being the only qualified professionals who can serve in these positions, that we think schools and communities deserve to have access. We have no argument with the expectations that professionals should be well prepared to work in schools, but we disagree with the position that the only valid preparation is a master's in school counseling. We hope to see more collaboration and an open system that values the multitude of disciplines that have contributions to make in our schools.
Thank you. And we're going to move on quickly. Again, another committee actually starts in here right at 3 o'clock. So if the next four people want to go ahead and come on, yes, as you start speaking, that would be great. And if each of you can make it really brief, that would be helpful.
Hey, Madam Chair, I'm William Mazenner. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and have worked in North Clackamas District as a social worker since 1992. And as Susie mentioned, the movers and the shakers, well, I've been the one providing those services to kids for the past 17 years. Most of my referrals come from school counselors seeking advice in my type of services. I'm in court on a regular basis. I'm working with families to get benefits, provide group counseling. I guess I'm the person providing the services, but the only way that I was able to do that is that I have a license. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. So,
thank you very much.
Please. My name is Karen Dittmar. I actually have brought testimony from myself and three other people, and we will just give you copies. And one of them is from Judy Schein, who is the immediate past president of the School Social Work Association of America. The other is from Paul Stager, who was an administrator in Portland Public Schools and now teaches both at University of Portland and Portland State in the Education Department. And the other is from Lori Huntwork, who is an MSW who is in practice in the Beaverton School District, who was so worried about losing her job that she went back and got an additional year in the School of Counseling, which was a lot of duplication of what she had in the MSW program and an extra year of tuition. And so that's from Lori. I am currently an adjunct professor at Eastern Washington University School of Social Work, Vancouver campus. I've taught the social work in schools.
And I'm going to urge you to summarize what's on the paper. We can read it, but there's still other people. Thank you.
I have worked in four states as a school social worker over 38 years. Oregon is the only state that I did not have certification in. I left Portland Public Schools, retired from there early, and went to work in Washington, in Vancouver, in the Evergreen School District for 11 years, where I followed the ASCA, the American School Counseling model, where I did groups, I did full classroom work, and individual work with high-risk students. Certification assures that social workers have the right training to get into school positions and that they have ongoing training. Washington requires 150 hours of ongoing education every 5 years to maintain certification. 32 states and the District of Columbia have certification for school social work. We'd like to see Oregon be the 33rd state, and we'd like to see them follow the model that's in the state of Washington.
Thank you very much. Please.
My name is Ellen Baltus, and I have a master's in social work, and I'm presently working as a child development specialist in North Clackamas and have been one for 15 years and worked prior in Portland Public Schools. And I was very excited to see this bill come forward, and I think it's long overdue, partly because the lack of a TSPC certification has caused confusion for districts wanting to hire social workers, but we don't seem to fit. Most employees in the school districts are TSPC certified, and so they're not quite sure what to do with MSWs that are in these roles, and so it creates barriers for hiring, despite the fact that they want social workers in the schools. And so I was very excited to see this piece of legislation, and I think it's way long overdue. And I really want to say, too, as the economy and as society has created greater need and more, I'm finding more and more vulnerable children and families, and yet I'm seeing more and more barriers to hiring social workers. And this piece of legislation, I think, validates and legitimizes the role of social workers in schools, where most of my families who are very fearful, I work in a Title I school, of services outside of the school, feel safe in a school setting receiving those services. And so we're a perfect location for that, and I think this bill will help address that. So thank you.
Thank you very much. We have about 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Jim Nash. I'm associate professor at the School of Social Work at Portland State. And a lot of my comments would echo what others have said. So I want to pull out of this one clarification is this year alone, we have 60 MSW students doing field placements, internships in public schools. So there's clearly a demand from the school system for our services. At the School of Social Work, we're eager to work with TSPC and other educational professionals to develop our curriculum so that our graduates would be qualified to meet the to fulfill the duties that are spelled out in this bill, and we would be also very eager to help with continuing education and the consultation. So the School of Social Work is totally behind this and would provide whatever assistance and support we could do to make it a reality. Thank you, and I can urge you to support the bill. Thank you.
My name is Monica Parmley. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and you've got a letter of my testimony, and I wanted to also quote from a letter from Susan McElroy, who is a principal in Portland Public Schools, and I'll just quote two sentences that I think are the most essential. As the demand for social services and mental health grows in our society, it makes a great deal of sense that social workers be placed in schools that are on the front line of serving students and families. State licensure of social workers by TSPC would allow for principals to have a choice about having the best candidate fill those positions based on the needs of the school. Please consider this request for state licensure from TSPC from a person who daily works with the social services as well as the educational needs of students and families.
Thank you very much.
And we have letters from other principals and district administrators that we will submit.
Thank you.
In support of the bill.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your patience today. I am holding this hearing open until next Monday, so if any of you want to come back on Monday, we will do this first
thing. What time would that be?
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock next Monday. You're welcome to come back, and we'll call you back up, and Representative Comp, you can have a chance to testify then as well. So thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much.
And I held that over, but I'm now closing the public hearing on House Bill 3205, and the House Committee on Education is adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.